Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 108. Speak by Laurie House Anderson.
It's hard to sleep at home. How long would it take for the nurses to figure out I don't belong here? Would they let me rest for a few days? It happened. There's no avoiding it. No forgetting.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that's brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. As always, I am Tom Panarese, and joining me for this one is my art class compatriot, Stella.
Yeah, your nerdy friend who helps you with dissections and also... some social justice against the racist history teacher.
Yes.
Yes, I'm glad to be here to talk about this banned book.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
It's banned books month, question mark?
Banned books week as of recording week. This was about a week or two ago. It's coming out in November, obviously. But yeah, October is like the second week in October. So this year was banned books week. So yeah.
Gotcha.
Slightly appropriate.
Yes, so indeed.
So how are you?
Yeah, doing okay. We're in the middle of fall, so I appreciate the temperatures. Mm-hmm. But this is also, I think, where the grades really start coming in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, writing interim reports and then the conferences and all of that. So it's been, October has been a busy time. I've like lost all of my weekends. And in sports news, the Bills have, I don't know what's happening here, but they should not have lost against the Patriots. They probably should not have lost against the Falcons. I'm worried. We need to get the Lombardi. Yeah. So, but such is life of a Bills fan. You understand the ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
So,
my wife was telling me that she's read that like this is a weird season so far because it seems like nobody is a breakout team at the moment because everybody seems to be like 4-2 and 3-3 and that sort of thing. So yeah. It's kind of interesting. I'll see how the rest of the season starts to shake out from here because we're hitting like bye weeks starting now. And yeah. So because I watched Washington blow it the other night, Monday night with the Bears Yikes. And such. And then I'm also watching the baseball playoffs too.
Yeah.
So.
The intersection.
Yeah. So, well, cool. Yeah. I agree with you on the grade thing. I have so much grading.
Yeah.
I do it to myself. I procrastinate too much and then it piles up. But I got through all of my AP and I have maybe, I think I'm like 2/3 of the way done with my freshman. So if I can finish it all tomorrow, I'll be very happy. Then I'll have more grading to do, but at least this backlog will be cleared out and such. Yeah. So
and then you can have a free weekend.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, as of, like I said, we're coming out in November. But as of this is a few nights before the Baltimore Comic Con, and I'm headed up on Saturday, and you're going to be there, and we'll probably do some recording and that sort of usual stuff. So by the time this comes out, my Pop Culture Affidavit episode about the Baltimore Comic Con should be out.
Yeah.
So
your tradition.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to it, and it should be really fun.
So, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get into this novel, which is not necessarily fun.
Which is
fun.
Not a fun. Yes.
Not necessarily fun.
Yeah.
But it is Speak, Laurie House Audition. What is your history with this book?
Yeah, I have known or at least heard the title of this for several years. And I don't know, I guess, what prevented me from reading it. Maybe it was just like a TBR and other things were taking priority. And then I think I was looking at maybe a list of YA literature that was pretty momentous and I think will always maintain some sort of spot on a best of list. Mm. And it had come up and then I had finally looked at what it was actually about. And I thought, oh, wow, I did not read it, however, but I did watch the film with Kristen Stewart. And I will say that I found that it was a good film because I know people debate whether she's a good actress or not. So I do recommend that, but I didn't read it. I had to double check after last episode on my Goodreads. So this is my first official time reading it.
Okay. My experience with Kristen Stewart, it depends on what role she's in. Like, I've seen movies where she's not really doing it for me. And then I've seen her in other things where I'm like, yeah, I can see why people like her so much. So,
yeah, I would say Twilight is not the best litmus of her abilities.
Yeah, that's from what I've heard. I have not actually, I might watch this movie. I put off watching the movie before we did the episode because I just wanted to go by the book. I'm kind of like you. This was one of those books that did when you looked at young adult literature and kind of milestone books, this was always on those lists. I knew what it was about on some level. And it just kind of kept passing it by, you know. This is the second time I've read it, and I was trying to remember the first time I've read it. And I want to say I read it for the young adult lit class I took in grad school, but that might be false. Or I might have read it around the same time. I do have a copy because at some point where people were giving away books and things like that, and I would like, they would end up in my classroom. It ended up in my classroom. So it just sits on the classroom bookshelf. And when I was trying to figure out a book to read for this episode, it kind of was looking, staring straight at me from there. I was like, well, let's do this one. It's been a while since I read it. So yeah, this is my second read through, but like you, it was, you know, I kind of put it off. And I'm, like I said, I'm pretty sure I read it as like one of the novels I chose for the grad school course, then that would have been at least almost 10 years ago. So yeah. So let's get into the background, right? Laurie House Anderson was born on October 23rd, 1961 in Potsdam, New York. She grew up there with her younger sister, Lisa. As a student, she showed an early interest in writing, specifically during the second grade. She also enjoyed reading, especially sci-fi and fantasy, but never envisioned herself becoming a writer. She attended Manlius High School in Manlius, New York, which is a suburb of Syracuse. And Syracuse is where the Syracuse suburbs is where the novel itself takes place. During Anderson's senior year, she moved out of her parents' house at the age of 16 and lived in as an exchange student for 13 months on a pig farm in Denmark. After experience in Denmark, Anderson moved back home to work at a clothing store earning minimum wage, and this motivated her to attend college. She began her career writing as a freelance journalist and worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer in the early years of her career. During this time, Anderson also began to write children's and young adult novels. Despite receiving rejection letters, Anderson released her first children's novel, Nindito Runs, in 1986, based on Kenyan Olympic marathon runners who ran at to and from school each day. Later that year, she had her story, Turkey Pox, published. The story was inspired by her daughter, Meredith, who broke out on chicken pox on Thanksgiving. In 1998, she published No Time for Mother's Day, featuring the same characters. During her early career, Anderson wrote several pieces of nonfiction. The first was a children's book featuring Saudi Arabia. She co-authored a book about parenting shy children with Dr. Ward Swallow. In 1999, Farrar, Straus, and Gros published Anderson's best-known novel to date, which is Speak. It's a New York Times bestseller and was adapted into a film in 2004, starring Kristen Stewart as Melinda Sordino. The novel became a finalist for the National Book Award and won Anderson Honors for its portrayal of a 13-year-old girl who becomes mute after a sexual assault. The paperback version was published in 2001 by Puffin Books, an imprint of Penguin. Speak has been translated into 16 languages. In 2018, she revealed that she was raped when she was 13 years old, and the novel was based on her experience. Anderson later wrote a memoir, Shout, about her life when she was a teenager, including details of her rape and the trauma that faced afterwards. In 2002, after the publication of Fever 1793, Catalyst was published by Penguin under the Viking imprint. The action takes place at the same high school as Speak and features a cameo appearance by some of its characters. The book became a Barnes & Noble bestseller and a Best Teen Book of 2002 and an ALA Best Book for Young Adults. Speak is a New York Times bestseller. It received several awards, including the American Library Association's 2000 Michael Prince Honor, the 2000 Gold Kite Award. It was selected as a 2000 ALA Best Book for Young Adults, and again, critical acclaim for its portrayal of the trauma caused by rape. Barbara Tannert Smith, the author of Like Falling Up Into a Storybook, Trauma, Intertextual Repetition of Laurie House Anderson's Speak, claims the story's ability to speak the reader's language brought about its commercial success. It has been censored as well, your challenged band, etc. It's ranked 60th on the ALA's top 100 banned challenged books for 2000 to 2009 and 25th for 2010 to 2019. In 2020, the book was named the fourth most banned and challenged book in the United States because it was thought to contain a political viewpoint and it was claimed to be biased against male students. I'm not kidding. This is from Wikipedia, by the way. Because it was thought to proclaim a political viewpoint, it was claimed it was biased against male students and for the novel's inclusion of rape and profanity, because if you're going to have a novel about sexual assault, don't put the sexual assault in the novel.
Yeah. How exactly did they give a reason of how it's a political viewpoint?
Is liberal feminist trash? I don't know. I don't know. I would imagine that's what it is. It's like anything that points out that, you know, men are capable of anything other than, like, you know, being the nicest person on earth is political or something.
It's interesting because the constant switching of the mascots smells more of a conservative side interesting.
Although in some cases I just thought that was being satirical. In September 2010, Wesley Scroggins, a professor at Missouri State, wrote an article, Filthy Books Demeaning to Republic Education, which he claims that Speak, along with Slaughterhouse-Five and 20 Boy Summer, should be banned for exposing children to immorality. He claimed that Speak should be classified as soft pornography and therefore removed from high school English curriculum. In its 2010 to 2011 bibliography, Books Challenged a Man, the Newsletter of Intellectual Freedom lists Speak as having been challenged in Missouri schools because of its soft pornography and glorification of drinking, cursing, and premarital sex.
If we read the same book.
Yeah, I know, right? In the 2006 Platinum edition of Speak and on her blog, Anderson spoke out against censorship, saying, but censoring books that deal with difficult adolescent issues does not protect anybody. Quite the opposite. It leaves the kids in the darkness and makes them vulnerable. Censorship is the child of fear and the father of ignorance. Our children cannot afford to have the truth of the world withheld from them. And there's a lot more. But yes, it has. It is one of those that came up. And it is the, you know, it is the content, because the content is very, this isn't a romance book by any means or something like that. That's why I find it interesting that this is pornography. There's no sex in this book that is not Melinda's assault. Again, it's like a more of a message book. Like, when we've seen message books like this over and over again, but then again, this is like the pearl clutching of a certain segment of the population who would rather, I don't know, I'm soapboxing, would rather people be ignorant of that so boys can get away with it. But that's my opinion. Anyway, shall we move on to the plot synopsis? So the plot synopsis I got from like, it's like litcircles.com or something similar to that. And it's pretty lengthy, so I'll do my best to make sure it doesn't take too long. So Melinda Sordino begins her freshman year at Meriwether High, depressed and alone. Throughout the day, students bully and isolate her. Her former best friend, Rachel, is particularly cruel. The only other person who will talk to her is Heather, an annoying new girl in town who is focused on social advancement. Cynical but perceptive, Melinda mocks every aspect of Meriwether. She only becomes excited in the art room, where the passionate Mr. Freeman tells his students that they'll spend the year on a single subject. Melinda gets a tree. And I should pause really quickly to say this is told in the first person, and it's like episode to episode and day to day. So it's almost like a journal in a sense, or at least kind of a blow by blow of what's going on in school. So we're really in Melinda's head. So Melinda describes her workaholic mother, her disinterested father. She discusses her hatred for her babyish bedroom, decorated when she was in the fifth grade. In the bedroom, Melinda hides her mirror. She loathes her appearance, especially her raw, bitten lips. In the following weeks, Melinda has an icy interaction with Rachel, spends time with Heather, who works on her tree, and begins to use an old abandoned janitor's closet in the school as a hiding spot. Although she was once happy and driven, she now feels detached and depressed. This depression worsens when the students at a pep rally recognize her as the one who called the cops on Kyle Rogers' party and torment her. Heather becomes angry with Melinda for being an unsupportive friend, but quickly apologizes. Meanwhile, Melinda's parents are upset about her low grades and her apathy. They scold her, but end up yelling at each other. In biology class, Melinda encounters David Petrakis, her brilliant lab partner. She continues to pay no attention to in her classes and spends Halloween by herself, remembering when she once had friends. Heather joins the Marthas. This is a preppy clique dedicated to community service. Although Melinda helps Heather with the Martha duties, the other girls make fun of her lips, causing Melinda to cry in a bathroom. Even worse, Melinda sees a male student she refers to it in the hallway. She freezes, describing him as my nightmare. Melinda cleans her closet and covers its mirror with a poster of Maya Angelou. She notes that it is growing harder to talk and is grateful for her closet because it allows her to hide her emotions. In her social studies class, after her bullying teacher, Mr. Neck, goes on a racist rant, I believe it's like an anti-immigration rant, very specifically, David Petrakis begins to protest for his own freedom of speech. On Thanksgiving, Melinda's mother tries and fails to cook a turkey because she forgot to defrost it. Her father can't cook the bird either, and after fighting, the family eats pizza. The next day, Melinda creates a sculpture using the turkey's bones. Mr. Freeman approves of the piece, as does Melinda's artistic former friend, Ivy. School continues, bringing an apple dissection in biology, and Melinda flashes back to a childhood memory in an apple orchard. And more protests from David in social studies. As winter break starts, Melinda feels nostalgic for her childhood. On Christmas, Melinda's parents give her a sketch pad and charcoals because they've noticed her drawing. Touched, Melinda almost tells them her secret, but cannot. In the days following winter break, she's forced to work at both her mother and her father's jobs. School starts up again and Melinda struggles with her tree. She helps Heather with a Martha poster project and faints during a frog dissection in biology after identifying with the dead frog. Heather, having been hired as a model, asks Melinda to hang posters. As she does, Melinda encounters it, who whispers, "Fresh meat," in her ear as she stands frozen. Hearing about her terrible grades, Melinda's parents scream at her. Melinda refuses to speak and spends the night in her bedroom closet, scratching at her wrist with a paperclip until blood appears. Matters grow even worse when it who is a senior named Andy Evans, begins to flirt with one of the Marthas, harassing Melinda as he does so. Melinda continues to earn terrible grades and makes no progress on her tree. After missing her school bus one day, she walks towards school only to see Andy, who once again targets her. She remains frozen and runs away from him, after which she decides to cut school, spending the day in the warm, sunny mall. School continues. Melinda's English class discusses symbolism in the Scarlet Letter. She tries to work on her tree. She becomes deeply depressed after Heather decides to stop being friends with her, telling her that she just needs professional help. On Valentine's Day, Melinda receives a Valentine she hopes and fears might be from David Petrakis. It's actually a friendship breakup Valentine from Heather, which causes Melinda to break down in her closet. She cuts school and ends up hiding in a hospital. Furious about her terrible grades, Melinda's parents have a dysfunctional meeting with her principal, whom she names Principal, and her guidance counselor. She remains silent as the adults argue and is forced to attend in-school suspension. Andy Evans is there and blows in her ear. Ugh. She fantasizes about killing him. On a positive note, she's inspired by the fractured work of Pablo Picasso. One day when she needs a ride to meet her mother, Mr. Freeman drives her and tells her that she needs to use her own tree to express her emotions. She actually studies for a biology test about seeds, even though she's increasingly depressed by her friendlessness. After sleeping too long in her janitor's closet, Melinda catches the final seconds of a winning basketball game. In the happy hubbub afterward, David Petrakis asks her to come over to his house for pizza, but she panics and declines. After a night of insomnia, Melinda climbs to her roof and flashes back to the night of Kyle Rogers' party, sneaking in with her group of friends, downing three beers to keep from feeling awkward, wandering off into the trees and being asked to dance by Andy. She recalls him kissing her and becoming more aggressive, and as her memories become fractured, remembers how he suddenly was on top of her and how she tried to say no until he covered her mouth with his hands. Barely coherent, she recounts how he raped her and how she dialed 911 afterwards but was unable to make a sound. As she flashes back to the present, she finds that she is bitten through her own lip. As winter turns to spring, Melinda has a positive interaction with Ivy but finds out that Rachel and Andy are dating. Horrified, she writes an unsigned warning note to Rachel. In social studies, she turns in an extra credit report on suffragettes and becomes excited about the topic until Mr. Neck tells her that she must read it aloud in front of the class. She and David come up with a plan, and Melinda protests for her right to silence, though David feels that she should fight for her right to speak. As Melinda works in the art room, Andy comes in looking for Rachel. Melinda is once again unable to speak as she approaches. Ivy comes in during the encounter and calls Andy bad news. The next day, Melinda wakes up with a fever and imagines being on Oprah and talking about her rape. It's May at last, and Melinda begins gardening. She and Ivy, meanwhile, name Andy Evans to a guy to stay away from in marker on a bathroom wall. Melinda gets stronger and even rejects Heather when her two-faced friend comes to ask for help making prom decorations. Feeling empowered, Melinda decides to talk to Rochelle. The interaction, because she hangs out with these foreign exchange students, so she starts calling her Rochelle. So sometimes she'll refer to her as Rachel/Rochelle. The interaction goes well up until the moment when Melinda tells Rachel that she was raped at the beginning of the year. Rachel's first horrified and concerned, but reacts with disbelief and cruelty when Melinda reveals that Andy was the perpetrator. Although deeply upset, Melinda becomes happier when Ivy shows her that many girls have added additional warnings about Andy to the wall. After watching arborists prune a tree in her yard, Melinda goes to visit the place where she was raped. In the quiet grove, she vows to nurture her old self like a seed, hoping that she will soon be able to grow once again. She spends a night with her parents without fighting, and then finds out that Rachel broke up with Andy at the prom. She's ecstatic and decides she doesn't need to spend time in her closet anymore. Melinda goes to clean out her closet, but Andy Evans follows her in. He calls her ugly and jealous and tells her that she's lying about her rape. He then vows to give her what she wants and attempts to rape her a second time. As he goes to unzip his jeans, Melinda screams no. She uses her turkey sculpture to break the closet's hidden mirror and holds a broken shard to his neck, leaving him speechless and terrified. As she does so, the entire girls' lacrosse team breaks down the closet door. Summer is close to an ending, and the summer school-bound Melinda finally finds herself popular because of the attack. She sits in the art room and at last creates an imperfect but beautiful tree. As she does so, she admits to herself that her rape happened, but that she will survive it. She then adds birds to her tree and begins to cry. As she does so, Mr. Freeman comes over and remarks that she's been through a lot. Melinda feels as though the ice in her throat is melting and says, "Let me tell you about it." So that is the plot to speak. Stella, did you like the book?
I did like the book, yes.
Cool. So did I. Even the second time, I thought it was... I thought the voice was very genuine, and I thought the way that she had this character isolate and be isolated by people spoke very true. What did you think of the fact that through much of the novel, like, she doesn't say anything to people? Like, she does kind of go mute a little bit. Is it gimmicky? Or do you think that is a really good storytelling device?
No, I think that it is a good storytelling device. If we were to look at the timeline of when this novel was written and was published compared to other ones, you know, if it came out any time later or now, for instance, perhaps the answer would be different. But I do feel like it's maybe the front runner of that sort of original idea. And I think it draws attention to what it is like to be a survivor of a sexual assault. The fear of telling somebody, you know, will I be believed? Will I not be believed? The fact that if you did tell someone you're not believed, it's like you shouldn't have spoken at all. That blame is often put on people, you know, the just world theory of, you know, good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. So you must have been doing something wrong, that sort of thing. And also being someone who just came from middle school, which middle school is a tough time. And that transition, you know, to ninth grade is difficult. I think it's also showing that dimension as well. So I think that it is really well done. And it begs a lot of questions. Like, I haven't looked at the questions you have, but, you know, as an educator, I was also looking at this novel in a different way. Think, you know, what would I have been doing with Mel to sort of reach her, because it just didn't seem like any of the teachers were making much of an effort, with the exception of her art teacher. And it's hard for a student to get by, I think, without saying anything. Personally, as I'll speak from my classroom, I make people participate. Often, you know, I would say like 80% of the time it's volunteering, but then there are times that I'm going to make you do some work and things like that. So that is also, it was something that I was considering the entire time, that I wondered if she was speaking more than she was noting in her book, because clearly she was talking to David. And I think she was talking to her art teacher. And was she really not talking at all at home? You know, those sorts of things. So lots of things to ponder. But to get back to your original question, I don't think that it's gimmicky. I think it's powerful.
I agree, because her becoming mute in the way she is happens like organically. It's not a men of protest, or it's not something, it is something that develops over time, that she loses the ability because what was taken from her. And pretty much, you know, I really don't have a ton to add to what you said, but I do like the fact that you pointed out that she does speak to some people, mostly people who she seems to trust. And we'll get into some of the relationships she has, even with like her own parents and stuff like that. But it is a portrayal of somebody who is deep into like the depression that has come after this. And you have a good point about the teachers. Like, her teachers are set up as like, they're a little bit caricaturish, but we're looking at them through her lens. And so they are sometimes going to be caricaturish, like Mr. Neck, the social studies teacher, or the English teacher, who's like, you know, at one point the English teacher wears this dress, everybody notices she never wore the dress again. So there's like, they all have these like weird personality traits, but then again, we're getting that through the eyes of a freshman. So like, you know, you kind of take that what you will. No, but I did kind of wonder, because like, you know, guidance was noticing, and she was getting in trouble with the principal and stuff. And Mr. Freeman clearly saw something. Didn't necessarily, now Freeman had his own issues, and with authority, but it is interesting that nobody else reached out, because, you know, you and I have taught students who are very quiet and maybe depressed, and, You know, there are signs you see and stuff, and you try to approach them where you can. And I think Melinda's dropping grades would have been a huge red flag. You know, sometimes these kids slip by because they're getting A's and B's, and therefore people don't notice because they're getting E's and B's, but like she was getting D's and F's and she's going to summer school and everything. So yeah, I was kind of curious about that. But what did you think of Melinda and her narration?
I enjoyed it. It is, as you said, it is her perspective. So I did feel like she was perhaps a bit harsh on some of the teachers, if only because I think that English teacher was going through something.
Yeah.
I think that as far as I can tell, like she was trying to find her kind of identity, which I found very powerful. And it's like so small that it's like she's someone that also like it's, that's somewhat what Melinda is trying to do also is find her own identity. Because I think at the end, she cuts her hair and dyes it ? And
yeah,
she seems maybe content or even happy. But some of the, you know, these teachers do, I think probably deserve, what they get, like Mr. Neck. And it, you know, it's born out of, pain and grief. And she, I think also, whether begrudgingly or willingly, gives props to people when they deserve it. I think Rachel, she is somewhat hard on. However, I think Rachel, that was the greatest betrayal because that was they were best friends. And so to have her just turn away, I think was hard. So I think a lot of that anger and hurt is coming out. But the I cannot recall her name, but the sports star, you know, she would compliment her and things like that. So yeah. I feel like she is a believable narrator because, of course, we always discuss that, whether it's someone that we can trust. But again, I think you have to look through her pain as well. And it's interesting to get this perspective because an adult is writing this, you know, to see this perspective and how kids, you know, 14 or younger are relating to adults and what home life might look like. I thought that it was insightful and realistic. I don't think I was ever annoyed by, you know, what she was saying or how she was saying it. So yeah, overall, I enjoyed her as a narrator. And I mean, obviously as a character, I was hurting for her the entire time. And there's a, I guess, a catharsis at the end, and it's victorious at the end. But part of me was like, man, in reality, how much, or like, what is the percentage that, you know, this guy would have actually gotten away with it, and that she would have just kind of suffered through this, and no one would have known. But I don't think that Anderson was going to end it like that. But I just wonder, like, is that the more realistic ending? But overall, yeah, I like Melinda as a character.
Yeah, we'll get around to the ending later, but I do agree with you that it almost like had to end, considering the audience and everything. Like, and as Melinda, I liked her a lot as well. You know, sometimes when you have an unreliable narrator, you're frustrated with them, right? I was frustrated for her and felt for her because, you know, you think of the relationships and the friendships she's lost, and she couldn't find the strength to tell what had happened to her because she was ashamed, couldn't comprehend it. Like, you know, for all the things. And so like Rachel, who is her best friend, you'd think she'd be the one that she would have told right away, either at the party or the next day or whatever. And she didn't. She just clammed up, and this whole thing with calling the cops on the party became the big rumor, and like it became the big thing, and that's what she was shunned for, and nobody knew what Andy did. And so it and the deeper she gets into it, the more time she goes, she starts to feel smaller and smaller and smaller, like even to the point where she's in her own house. And that's where you get the cynicism she narrates with and some things. And it's a kind of a biting look at high school. But and I liked your point about the English teacher trying to find her identity, because all of the girls maybe even the exception of Ivy, who really is a lot sure of herself compared to Melinda and Heather and Rachel. They're all trying to find themselves in some way, right? Like Heather is desperate to be popular. She's like the new kid, and then she becomes a model at one point. And I think she starts to exhibit, like, you know, eating habits that are not healthy in terms of, like, not eating, you know, watching calories and that sort of thing. Rachel ends up dating Andy, you know, and she's, again, the whole queen bee aspect of her in the ninth grade. And they are all obviously trying to forge or find their identity within high school, because that's what you're trying to do as a freshman. You're scared out of your mind half the time, even if you don't have something like this happen to you. And what's sad is that nobody does seem to notice, except for when things get bad and then they just simply yell at her, and or she gets in trouble as opposed to actually getting help. And that's really frustrating, right? So, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about her friends. We'll start with Heather. She's a new girl. Yeah. So she doesn't know who Mel is. When she gets there, she hooks up with the Marthas. She gets this modeling contract. What is her purpose in the story? And how is Anderson using Heather to bring to light maybe other common issues that surround teenage girls at that age?
Yeah, it was interesting because in the plot synopsis, it immediately clocks her as annoying. And I feel like maybe my patience was stronger than the typical. Same. But I think maybe I did not find her annoying until she maybe like the, I don't know, the maybe the first time that, oh, the decorating of the faculty lounge.
Mm.
And it was a combination because I think Melinda is also wise that she, I think, really kind and generous because she tries to distance herself. And so that, you know, her miasma doesn't blow off on Heather. But Heather also takes it and runs with it and says that, you know, she was just in there or whatever. But yeah, not giving credit and constantly going to her. And lots of, I mean, I'll get to your question, obviously, but
yeah, no, keep going.
So I think we see her. It's one of those people, which I'm sure we've all had friends where they are constantly telling you their problems, but you might be struggling with something and like, there's no room for that in the relationship. It's only about them.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was that because she very much wanted to be with this in crowd, and when it wasn't working or when she was being used, I mean, she was basically like an indentured servant almost. It was all about how hard that was. And then Melinda's problems were rubbing off on her that, you know, you don't even, you know, your social issues. And it's like, you haven't even asked what's going on with Melinda. You know, that could have been the person had it been an authentic friendship. I think that Melinda could have opened up to her, but that was not the one. It was probably appropriate that it was Rachel that she told. So yeah, social commentary wise, I definitely think it is the dangers of bandwagoning in school and wanting to be popular. And I think, you know, people are popular. It like happens. There's almost no rhyme or reason. Potentially it could be based off of clothes, personality, yeah, whatever. But if you are striving for it, I think to an unhealthy degree, this is where like there is a concern. And the fact that her social status was more important than everything else and that she had to cut Melinda out in order to succeed, I think that was pretty awful. And then having that, I almost laughed, I was muted, but the fact that, yeah, it's like a friendship breakup note on Valentine's Day, it's like one of the worst things. So I do think it's the struggles that we have all gone through. I think even as adults, we have social issues. There's still a social chain. You know, you and I know,
yeah,
both, that there are cliques still, you know, in our workplaces and things like that. And yeah, I think you just need to be cautious with that. So that's, I think, what I would say, and maybe like a priority of loves, like in what order are you loving things? And so I think she very much put her social status above other people, and I think that's maybe a disordered love. So that would be my thought on what that commentary, but what Anderson might be saying about Heather as a character.
Yeah, she just allowed herself to get sucked into things and then be treated terribly. And with the modeling, you can see that if it goes too far down the road, she could develop like an eating disorder or something. Yeah. Because, you know, not that models all do, but you know, that cautionary tale.
It already started, though. Yeah, I mean, there's evidence of that in the novel where she would complain about. Yeah.
So. Yeah. No, I agree with you. It's this person who is needy and wanting. And part of it I thought was when she started was being the new girl with it. You're right. The fact that she doesn't really allow for anybody else to express what they're bothered by, et cetera. And it's all me. You know, and teenagers can tend to be like that sometimes, but this is particularly egregious. And then she hangs up with the Marthas, who there's a social hierarchy. You were talking about that. What I found interesting is they're like the Plastics or the Heathers, right? That's the image I'm getting, but they're like community service mavens or something. Like every project is service. Now, in my mind, it's ironic because it's service for the sake of their reputation.
Yeah.
And like, so they're really doing it for themselves. And they're also like constantly correcting the behavior of Heather and others because of their superiority. I thought that was an interesting twist, because, you know, they could have very well been just, you know, awful bitchy people and not had any real connection to the school except for lording over it. Or they could have been these kind of like, you know, party girl burnout types or something. The cool chicks, but probably among the adults, they're probably really liked because of the fact that they are so helpful to the community. I mean, did you find that as interesting as I did, that that's the angle she went with?
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, that answered the question. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, because you know, I often wonder about, listen, I have friends who are in sororities, I have former students, but you know, sororities always, I feel like their central message is always is a community service oriented sorority. Yeah. And so it's like, okay, but is it really, you know, that sort of thing. So that's almost what I thought of.
No, I actually completely agree with you. It did remind me of a sorority. And then we have Rachel, and we'll get to the thing with her and Andy a little bit later when we get toward the end of the novel. But at the beginning, like Rachel and Melinda were like besties. They were like best friends. And it's sad that Melinda can't tell Rachel like right after what happened to her. And then Rachel starts hanging out with, she starts taking French, I believe, and she's hanging out with foreign exchange students. She refers to herself as Rachel. Yeah.
And Raquel, I think.
At one point. Yeah. Like, what was your take on her as a character? I mean, I think she's a pretty terrible friend. Obviously, she pretty much becomes an enemy at one point or another. But like, did you see any good in her? Like, how did you perceive her as a person and a character in the novel?
Yeah, I was just struck by a dark thought, Tom, in regards to your previous question, that this novel could intersect with Sharp Objects because of the group of young women.
Oh, know? Yeah, the girls who end up killing
Absolutely. So. Anyway, but we'll get back to that. I was just thinking like, oh, wow, yeah, those could be the Marthas, right?
Yeah.
Do their community service by day, by night, they're murdering people.
And pulling teeth.
Yes. I think there is good in Rachel, but I wish we could speak to the author, obviously. My perception is that she, similar to Heather, is so persuaded by or manipulated by, we could say, I think, social status and who she wants to be that she is going to push off any sort of negativity, or as I called it before, this miasma that is Melinda, or that is following Melinda around. So because immediately, you know, everyone clocked that Melinda was the one, which I don't know how that happened exactly, unless she just stood by the phone at the party, because she didn't even say anything. She didn't say her name, because remember the police said they were asking and she wasn't saying anything, and they said, oh, that's okay, we have your location. So I don't know how everyone found out, but they did nonetheless. But I think she just knew that Melinda was going to be this pariah the next year, and so she decided that she would separate herself. So I do think that there is some good in her, but she just has made poor decisions. And then her interactions with Melinda, which seem to get a bit better, because it's really ignoring. And then they have a somewhat nice conversation in the library, which then quickly turns into a bad conversation. And then it turns around. So yeah, it certainly takes some time for her to come around. And she definitely has some penance, I think, to make as well.
And growing up to do, she's an incredibly immature person who gets by the end of the novel and is in a very mature situation. I agree with you. She's not totally a terrible, terrible person. You can see that she still feels for Melinda, like the social aspect of it and the reputation and all that have overridden that goodness, but it's still there, and it, you know, it has to be brought out of her at the right times and things. I get the feeling that either one or two things happened at the party as far as how they knew who called the cops. One, somebody simply saw her, recognized her at one point, and it just spread as a rumor.
By the
two, yeah, somebody saw her by the phone making the call, and then eventually put two and two together, and the rumor started to spread among people that by the time they got back to the party, the school in August, it was like everybody knew, or everybody knew somehow, and, you know, because rumors spread pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And then Rachel probably picked up on it, and that's why she froze her out and everything. You know, Melinda was also isolating herself at that point, too. The other one, which is less realistic, but I could totally see happening, is that Andy started the rumor.
Oh.
To throw anybody off the idea, because, like, where the hell were you? You know, to throw anybody off that idea. But I think that's less realistic than the rumor just kind of spread naturally or organically, because rumors fly around schools like that. In fact, there's really two rumors going in the school. There's the one about Melinda, but then there's the one Melinda, not really a rumor about Andy, but the whole writing on the bathroom wall pit, which Ivy, I think it's that Ivy takes her into the bathroom and they start talking about some stuff. And she notices the people have written on the bathroom wall about different people. And so she writes boys to watch out for, or bad news, I think it is, or whatever it is. And puts his name down, and then later on, after the fight with Rachel, she shows her that people have added so much crap about Andy that, like, clearly they all agree that he's not, you know, a nice person. And I find it interesting that the anonymity is really important here. Like, there's a power of anonymity in the book, both positive and negative. Like, where do you see that? Where do you see that, and what do you why do you think it's so important?
Yeah, because I think the knee-jerk reaction to that is, my gosh, if this has happened to so many people, why didn't everyone speak up beforehand? Mm-hmm. Which that is, you know, I think it's a feeling that many people are going to have, but I caution you against it, obviously, because, again, you know, everyone has a different trauma response, and we're witnessing what one of those trauma responses are. And I think there's a lot of fear for to speak up in those cases, because will I be believed? That's a super powerful scene, especially because it's juxtaposed with, I think, a lot of girls being written on there, if I'm not mistaken, and, like, basically being called sluts and whores, or, like, betrayers and things like that. Am I wrong that it was mostly girls on the bathroom wall and then she decided to put Andy there?
I'm flipping through the book.
Okay. Right now. Yeah, the power of anonymity. So it pops up there, pops up with her left handwritten note because she's right-handed. The thought that you can maybe help somebody out without revealing your identity and that it might be more trusted is interesting and sad because she does the note because she doesn't think that Rachel's going to listen. And of course, that is proven in the library conversation. And then I think for writing on the bathroom wall, it seems like to me it's something for her to get out, to actually put it there because she is unable to verbalize it. So why not write it down? And that seems to be the only way that she's able to get out a portion of what has happened to her. So it's almost her way of speaking through what has happened without literally speaking.
Ivy's got markers like in her hair bun or whatever, but they're uncapped. And that's how, and Melinda brushes up against her. So they end up in the bathroom so that Ivy can clean Melissa's shirt. So it's on pages 173 to 175. So she's, as Ivy's cleaning up the shirt, she notices the writing. She says, "Who is Alexandra?" I ask. And Ivy says, "I don't know any Alexandras. There might be an Alexandra in 10th grade. Why?" According to this, she has pissed off a whole bunch of people. One person wrote in huge letters that she's a whore, and all these others added on little details. She slept with this guy. She slept with that guy. She slept with those guys, all at the same time. For a 10th grader, she sure gets around. Ivy doesn't answer. I peer through the crack between the door and the wall. She opens the soap container and dips my shirt in it. She scrubs the stains. I'm shiver. I'm standing in a bra, not a terribly clean bra, and it's freezing in here. Ivy holds the shirt up to the light, frowns, and scrubs some more. I want to take a deep breath, but it smells too bad. Remember what you said about Andy Evans being big trouble? Yeah. Why did you say that? What I find interesting is she's talking during this whole thing. She's comfortable enough to be in her underwear in a bathroom with Ivy and having a conversation with her. So this is her opening up a little bit more, and it's to somebody that she's gained. Ivy has gained her trust again. So she rinses this out from the shirt. He has such a reputation. He's only after one thing. If you believe the rumors, he'll get it no matter what. She wrings the water out of the shirt. The sound of dripping water echoes off the tiles. Rachel's going out with him, I say. I know. Just add that to the list of stupid things she's done this year. What else does she say about him? We don't really talk, I say. She's a bitch, that's what you mean. She thinks she's too good for the rest of us. Ivy punches the silver button on the hand dryer and holds up the shirt. I reread the graffiti. I love Derek. Mr. Neck bites. I hate this place. Syracuse rocks. Syracuse sucks. List of hotties, list of jerks, list of ski resorts in Colorado everyone dreams about. Phone numbers that have been scratched out with keys. Entire conversations scroll down the bathroom stall. It's like a community chat room, a metal newspaper. I ask Ivy to hand me one of her pens. She does. I think you're going to have to bleach this thing, she says, and hands over the shirt as well. I pull it over my head. It's still damp. What do you want the marker for? I hold the cap in my teeth. I start another subject thread on the wall. Guys to stay away from. The first entry is the beast himself, Andy Evans. I swing open the door of the flourish. Ta-da! I point out it's my handiwork, and Ivy grins. So I like how, like, verbal she is in this point, right? She's, you know, prior to this, she was so, she wouldn't have said all these things to Ivy, but that's the whole thing. Like, she does see the very typical writing on the bathroom wall about different girls and things like that, but she adds it to herself, and it really, really does work, and such. And I think it's just as powerful a scene as some of the other scenes in the book. Because there's a weird agency in like her like getting that out there. The same way she does the letter to Rachel, which you wonder if Rachel ever read it. Did you get the impression that she did?
She did because during the library scene, after Melinda says about Andy, she says, "You were the one who left that note, weren't you?"
Mm. Okay, I couldn't remember that. Yeah. So... yeah, so I think it's a powerful scene, and I really liked how that was. And I like how the... she's not even looking to form a friendship with Ivy. Like, Ivy is there, and it's almost like the two of them reconnect. Because I think they were friends prior. And then things kind of become better between them without much effort on either of their parts. It just happens to happen. And so that's promising in a way that I think even Melinda doesn't really realize at first, which is really cool. Speaking of names and anonymity, She provides nicknames to many of the other characters through the novel. Why this? I mean, we all do it, but like, why her? Why? How does it contribute to the development of the story and your experience as a reader?
The nicknames?
Yeah. Principal, principal.
Yeah.
Neck. It.
You know, that cracks me up. I just think of, who is that one pundit that I don't think he does NFL anymore? He had glasses. This is not going to be helpful. Glasses, like one of those.
Oh, flat, Keith Olbermann?
No.
Okay.
Those flat hairstyles. Mm. What's it called? Shoot. And then he had a son, and his son played football for UVA.
Mm. Oh, Howie Long?
Yes. Chris Long. And yeah. Chris Long had a very thick neck. Like, it did not look like there was any sort of separation. So when I heard neck, I'm just like, it's probably that. You know how those...
Yeah.
I don't know why they do it, but there is a machine where you, like, put your head in a little loop, and then you're supposed to be lifting up this weight. And I'm like, why do you need your neck to be... Someone can explain to
me. I've seen those, yeah.
It's nuts. It seems like some sort of medieval torture device. Yeah, I think it definitely... What was the English teacher's name?
Oh, I don't remember. Like,
okay. Yeah, well, I think it very much tells us everything we need to know about them as Melinda sees them. Mm-hmm. Principal, yeah. It seems like he... For me, he's like... an administrator name only. Like, is he even productive or doing anything to guide the school? Mr. Neck, like I said, I just see that. I feel like he is probably a toxic male. We kind of get that sense from his explosion against immigrants randomly. I wondered if it was going to turn out that his son was at that party. And he, because he has, it seems like he has some sort of vendetta against Mel. Though that's one of those things, you know, how sometimes students think that we have it out for them. So, I couldn't tell if that was that or Mr. Neck really was that terrible. I guess because the people that she calls by their actual name, I think she has some sort of fondness for, like the art teacher. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I just think that she has no desire to get to know them or have any sort of relationship with them. And so she very simply calls them by some sort of defining feature.
Hair woman is what she refers to her English.
Yeah.
Although she doesn't use that as much as neck. I don't think she has as much disdain for hair woman as she has pity in a number of places.
The symbolism.
Yeah.
You get that a lot? Did you feel for that in those scenes?
A little bit. So, Mr. Freeman, though, right? So he is he's almost like a caricature of the art teacher. He's like going to be the new guy, the new way of doing things. Like, he has them like chart their grades on like the wall, like, and he gets in trouble with like the school board over it or something, to the point where like deflates him completely, because he was painting like a mural or a painting or something about the school or whatever, and he just like completely stops. But he is, out of everybody, the one person who encourages Melinda and tries to foster her personality. But I feel that, as kooky as this guy is, I feel he's going about it a little bit the right way, because he's not afraid to criticize her as well. So he's not just kind of blowing smoke up her rear end. He genuinely cares for her, which is why he's so pushy about the art projects and things like that. It did get a little irritating about how like anti-establishment he is, and like when he would go off in his little rants and stuff like that. But I also wondered if the kids like completely tune him out too. You know, what was your impression of Mr. Freeman?
Oh, Mr. Freeman. Yeah. I think Mr. Freeman is... he's definitely someone who I think believes in his work, and by work I think what he's trying to teach is curriculum, but is being held back by bureaucracy and administration. I think he develops good relationships, but I don't know that that is necessarily his priority, just because when they're picking things out, and I think it's Ivy who's scared of clowns, like there's no empathy there whatsoever.
Yeah.
But he also is, you know, people flock to him. I think he's one of those teachers who has, maybe to use like a new wave term, like this aura, I think people feel safe around because his lunchroom is open. And I think a lot of people go there until some rowdy boys, I think, got kicked out. Yeah. And I think there's a reason that Melinda tries so hard in that course, because even though she tells us it's very intermittent of, you know, I studied for this, dot, dot, dot. You can tell with however many of those blocks that she destroyed, you know, mm-hmm. that she is, I think part of it is she's working through everything through this tree, but also I think she does care about the class and by extension, the teacher as well. So yeah, I think complicated. I mean, I'm one of those teachers who prides herself on trying to have good relationships with students and feel like that is the foundation, and everything else becomes easier. At least it's not easy, but it's easier because I feel like if you don't have a relationship with the students, then anything you teach is really going to fall on deaf ears.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily see him as someone who is looking like that's his intentionality, but it seems like it comes to him because of his love for art and the actual classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you, because he could very well be that kind of like hip cool teacher with a lot of groupies and things like that. But yeah, he does have his steps. The whole thing with Ivy and the clown is kind of funny. But you know, Mel keeps destroying the Formica blocks, not Formica, they're linoleum, and he's just will not let up. And it's pushing her, but it's also like she's becoming a little bit perfectionist about her. She's becoming very frustrated, but it's helping her work through it. And then finally, she's like, he's like the first adult that she tells this to. And at the very, very end, you know, I mean, like, I'm sure that at one point it got back to her parents and her principal and everything, but it's like she sat down with him and like, I'm going to tell you the story. And I think that's a very powerful moment at the very, very ending. And then we have the other guy in the novel who is nice to Melinda, which is David. David, geeky David, who takes up against Mr. Neck, in who goes on this rant about immigrants, et cetera, et cetera. Some things never change, right? And then David like protests for free speech and pisses Mr. Neck off. And then David's like the science, and clearly David likes her. Are you shipping them?
I am. I think now is not the time,
mm-hmm.
especially because she has some things that she needs to work through.
Yeah.
But I could see that as like seniors, you know, they finally come together.
Yeah. I picture David as one of two characters that I've seen in movies. One is, if those of you out there listening, both of you, who have seen the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High, there's a character Brian Backer plays, is called, his name is Mark Ratner. And he's the one who falls for Jennifer Jason Leigh. And they, you know, of course, like, she's out of his league. And she is kind of this girl who goes like really fast and is with his friend and stuff. But he's like this quiet, sweet, nerdy kid. And such, and they do end up together at the end. The other kid I think of is, if you've ever seen the movie Eighth Grade.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the nerdy kid that, like, the end, like, she's hanging out at his house, and he's, like, making her, like, chicken nuggets or something, and he's this, like, nerdy, nerdy kid. And that's kind of what pops into my mind when I was reading David Petrakis's character. He's such a sweet kid, and really this, like, really this note of like hope or niceness to her, despite all of everything, you know, like so many people treat her so terribly and she's so guarded toward him. Like one point he does invite her over. He's like, why don't you come to my house for pizza? And she's like really scared for a variety of reasons, you know? And it's that kind of broke my heart a little bit. I was like, oh, I really wish you'd gone with him. Like, you know, but I think you're right. It's not the right time. And that eventually they probably would get together. But no, I really liked his character. Last set of characters, and then we're going to get to some of the deeper things, some of the symbolism, as well as the scene and the thing. But let's talk about Mel's parents, who are constantly fighting with one another. And then all they do is yell at her. Yeah. And then really at one point in the synopsis is they're really yelling at each other. She's like a fifth wheel or third wheel at her own home. Like, she does think at one point or another that if she was not there, it wouldn't matter. Like, her parents would her parents even notice? Yeah. It's really sad. You know, what happens to her at the party with Andy is horrific. And then this compounds it by being sad because she has no place to go because of the way her parents' marriage is and the way her parents are toward her. So when she finally does get a sanctuary, it ends up being a janitor's closet and she's by herself. And, you know, I found myself, even toward the end, where she starts gardening and like her parents start seeing the work and they start kind of things thaw a little bit and her dad starts doing a little bit more. Even then, I'm side-eyeing it a little bit because it's like, you should have been there for her the whole time and she could never talk to you because of the way you treat each other and then treat her. I mean, how do you feel the same sort of like anger toward them as I do, or am I just being dramatic?
No, I don't think you're being dramatic. I also felt like she's sleeping in her closet at home too. Mm-hmm. It's kind of one bit of a throwaway scene where her mom comes in and puts a blanket over her. And I'm like, what's happening here? Why yeah. aren't the parents like asking more questions?
Yeah,
they don't. I guess empathetically, I could say that they're so confused and concerned that it's coming out in a poor way. So that's like, that's as much grace as I think I can mm-hmm. give, but there's clearly like some issues between the two of them, and they are just not, I think, parenting as a parent, as I foresee a parent should be, trying to get more to the cause of the problem. And she's a lot of deficit language about, you know, because Mel in eighth grade, I think, was a solid maybe B+, mm-hmm. you know, student. And then so these disastrous, like, the question would be why.
Yeah.
But the way they go about it is just pretty bad. So, and then the turkey, I think, is symbol, and then their work stuff, and during her breaks, you know, that she can't get breaks anymore because she's a high school student. I'm like, this is probably the one person who really needs all the breaks. And then once she is deemed a productive member of society, you know, they start giving her some praise and things like that. But no, I disagree. You know, not being a parent myself, obviously I hesitate to make any sort of judgment, but I don't think that they were good parents, and I have a lot of issues with how they are going about their lives.
They treat her almost like she's an extra burden on them, that she's a problem, or she is something that they have to deal with, as opposed to their daughter. So it just adds to the list of problems they have. And yes, it's okay to get angry and frustrated at your kid if they are performing like that. But at the same time, you're right. They never sit down and talk to her and ask her what the hell is going on in a way that is productive. They never ask her, why are you hurting? What happened? It's always that language of what is wrong with you, in that sort of negative connotation, that why must I be bothered by the fact that you can't handle your own thing? They're very immature people, and they're essentially starting to parentify her. You know, like, she's, if this kept going, she'd essentially be raising herself for the rest of the time because she has to fend for herself. And she does that already to a certain extent. And it's because they're highly immature people, and they are always mad at each other. And it's very, very, it's upsetting to me that that's the environment that they have created for her. It has nothing to do with what happened to Andy, with Andy. Like, there's no, it doesn't factor into that, but it factors into the fact, into the way that she responds to it and her decline in her mental health, because they do not provide an environment for her that allows her to cope or grieve. So she has to go for the closet, which is where she goes. It's this abandoned janitor's closet. She turns it into this little hiding hole, or hidey hole, as she says. It helps save her, but at the end of the novel, Andy traps her in the closet and she gets out. So like, how does that whole thing, like the sanctuary of the closet and then Andy trapping her in that, contribute to like the themes of the novel and the messages that Anderson is trying to get across?
Yeah. And can I also point out, I mean, going back to episode one of this show, maybe not episode one, episode three, that Maya Angelou was also sexually mm-hmm. assaulted. And so to have that poster in the closet, I think is.
Yeah. Oh, that's really a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. But she is, it's interesting because I feel like she has turned a corner at that particular climax. I'll call that the climax of the novel.
Yeah, it is.
Because she's taking everything down. So she's like ready to move on from this closet. And then, of course, you know, that is when the predator strikes again. I've lost track. What was your question again?
Like, how does it contribute to, like, the theme of the novel? Is it symbolic, in a sense?
Yeah. Oh, the protection of the closet.
The protection of the closet, and then Andy, what happens with Andy? And then,
yeah. I think that the fact that... it maybe goes back a little bit to your anonymity. I'm thinking about, mm-hmm. you know, you were talking about when she was actually speaking, you know, in full sentences and multiple sentences to Ivy, and she was, yeah, you know, half naked. She was in a stall, right? She was in a bathroom yeah. stall, so she couldn't be seen. So I feel like there is that anonymity and safety there in the closet. I think some people who aren't claustrophobic, I think, find small confined spaces that are away and that could be locked, I think, from the inside, you know, to be pretty safe and secure. And yeah, this is her kind of day-to-day refuge. And so I like the fact, so I'll just say again, you know, the fact that I think she's turned a corner somehow and, you know, mm-hmm. she's decided to move on from this. But with Andy breaking in there, which I don't know how, unless he followed her.
When she was taking the stuff down, she'd left the door open.
Oh. Okay.
And he either was following her or walked by.
Yeah. Okay.
So he spotted her.
Okay. I had to suspend my disbelief a little bit mm-hmm. on that particular side. But I think it's, for me, I just feel like predators can strike anywhere that you're not necessarily, you know, safe. You know, predators strike when you go to the bathroom in a restaurant, you know, yep. that sort of thing. So just like these normal everyday places that you think, oh, this should be fine. You might get attacked, unfortunately. And this is like, I don't have a document up to cite my sources, but these are facts.
Yeah, no, I know.
So yeah, I just want to say that to the audience at large. But yeah, I think part of it is potentially that reason. And yeah, it's just such a violation, right? He violated her body. And he's about to do it again. And then he mm-hmm. violates this sanctum sanctorum, right, that she has. Sorry about that, Dr. Strange. yeah, so I think that's as much as I could, I think, say about it without, I think, you know, BSing my way. But those are the things that I truly believe about what's going on with that closet.
Yeah, that's pretty much the answer I would have. Like that it's a violation again, and then it allows her to find her voice and fight back at the end. But what if she never found the closet? What happens then?
Yeah, I wonder. Well, because after that first scene where she actually accidentally gets hit by some food
uh-huh.
by somebody, and I think she ran off. I cannot yeah. recall where she ran off. But I feel like she would have found someplace. I don't know if it would have been... would she have skipped class and mm-hmm. been in the art room somehow? And, you know, he would have just let it happen because, you know, he's kind of raging against Big Brother anyways.
Yeah.
Would she have been in the bathroom frequently? Because you always see that in teen movies and things, you know.
If yeah, they're hiding toilet, in the
toilet. Yeah. yeah, they're like eating.
And the feet on the seat of the toilet.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
nobody knows they're there.
So yeah. I feel like she would have found a place to do it. Because I mean, she went to the hospital, right? So it's clear that she's just like looking for some sort of place that is safe for her.
Yeah. She does start cutting herself at one point, but it doesn't seem like it goes on beyond the one instance that's described with the paperclip and such. So I don't know if that becomes a habit or if that's just like the one time under that much duress or stress. But I agree with you. I just worry that she never finds any sanctuary. It becomes a story where she is close to suicide or something, or she's thinking of something that drastic. Because she has no sanctuary unless she finds somewhere, right? Or someone, like the people who are supposed to provide her shelter from that particular storm are not doing it. And I wonder if that would become a, like, you know, how often does she think of that, of ending herself and things, which is a scary thing to think about and contemplate. But I would imagine that in the situation she's in, the thought has crossed her mind. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree.
Yeah, so sticking on symbolism, is there any, see, let's, we'll go with Mel. We'll stay with Mel. Attention is paid by other people to Mel's lips. Yeah. Is there something more than stitches or a scar? Because we were told that she nearly bit through her lip during the rape.
Yeah, this was a question that I added. Mm-hmm. I would like to hear what you have to say. So I don't know if nearly biting through. I'm thinking about stitches. I feel like, because that happened at the beginning of summer or at the end of summer at the party?
The beginning of the...
Okay.
I don't know exactly. It was the beginning. It was before the school year.
Right, yeah. So I just wonder, you know, how long would potentially that last? The stitches. Yeah. So I feel like stitches would be out there. It would maybe be a scar. But yeah, just the attention that is brought. I mean, there were a couple times of like, what's up with her lips, et cetera. And I just wonder if, like, as a nervous tick, and again, yeah, the symbolism of not speaking, that she's maybe gnawing on her lips or something like that, or it's just the scar. I wondered if you had any thoughts or insight or what you, thought about it.
I thought about... the lips, the scar, and also the lips are probably, like, I'm picturing something that's very, very chapped and rough.
Yeah.
And that it stands out among all of the people who are, the pretty people who are putting a lipstick and things like that. And it almost does represent, like, her, in a sense. Like, the fact that she loses the ability to speak or isn't speaking very much. And these lips and stuff present her like they, it's almost like they don't work. And the scar tissue being cut up, etc., physically symbolizes that in a sense. But maybe it does kind of stick out in that maybe there, whatever happened was so severe that she did develop a scar or something. Mm. You know, people point those things out. Somebody who knows this from personal experience regarding scars that kept getting pointed out. People do point those things out, especially at that age in high school and things. Mm. And when she's already the person who has the rumor about her, it's another piece of fuel to the fire, right? So I think it is pretty important in that regard, and that it makes her stand out, but it also becomes a source of her own pain and things like that. On a slightly lighter note, before we get to the Andy, the mascot. Did you think there was any deeper symbolism or meaning behind constant change of the school mascot? I thought it was just a little bit of a silly satirical interlude joke, like a little bit of comic relief among all the seriousness. I guess we could stretch it to the whole idea of, like, you're trying to find your identity. So the school itself is full of people trying to find their identity. So that kind of fits. What's your thought? You had asked the question to begin with. So what is your thought?
Yeah. I also wondered if it was some sort of commentary on, you know, when parents get involved in like this, which is also foreshadowing the author's own book, right? That it would be challenged and banned and all of this stuff. That, you know, we don't want anything to do with the devils, or, you know, don't want any sexually explicit cheers and things like that. So Yeah, I just found it interesting that that was a through line as the constant changing. I'm like, I've, you know, my high school Golden Eagles, it was the whole way through, and UVA, you know, has been the Cavaliers. Yeah. That hasn't changed. The Wahoos. So, yeah, I don't know.
We were the Golden Flashes. So,
wow,
yeah.
And, what's
yeah,
a flash?
A lightning bolt.
Oh, I see.
They were lightning bolts. Purple and gold, the gold lightning bolts. So yeah, no, I was wondering it too. And I could equate it to something like, you know, how everybody seems to be trying to find themselves and nobody is like clearly defined. And it's, but it also, I think it is a send up a little bit of over-involved parents. And I think it does help for some comic relief in a real sense. It also kind of helps when Melissa like cut through all the BS of high school, you know, like, because she's clearly like becoming cynical, or she's just like, look at this crap. So it's a good example for us to see that side of her that has nothing to do with her friendships or anything like that. It's just kind of commentary as a whole. So I thought it was cute sometimes too. It's kind of, it made me chuckle. Mel refers to Andy as it up until maybe about like 2/3 of the way through the novel. And then she starts referring to him as Andy and the monster and it like interchangeably. Why do you think it takes her so long to tell us the name of this guy and the significance of that? And this kind of goes into the next question I have is, why does Anderson wait so long to show us that even reveal that? Because we don't know it to be, and, you know, I mean, if you read the jacket or whatever, if you knew the novel going in was about rape, you'd know that. But if you went in cold, you would not know what happened to her at this party was that she was raped until a good portion of the way through a novel. There's hints at it, but it's not explicitly stated. So why hold off on that? And why hold off on revealing Andy?
Absolutely. Well, I think it builds suspense.
Obviously. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is always what I tell my students when we're doing Virgil and he delays to say somebody's name for the end of the line. I'm like, it's suspense. but this obviously over, you know, 7 or 6 words is quite different because it's hundreds of pages or 100 pages. I think it. For me, it definitely builds suspense, but I think it's also very much as far as I believe representative of someone coming to terms with what had happened and being unable to name the thing, but knowing that the thing happened and not wanting, you know, trying to push it out as far as you can, you know, out of your mind. And so not naming it, not giving it humanity, which, you know, Andy, and then because she's unable to speak about it, why even would she narrate to us or to herself about it? Mm-hmm. So those are the reasons why I think that she, And I think also calling a person a pronoun, a third person, impersonal pronoun, makes it easier to deal with, you know, just like this object almost rather than a human being.
Yeah. I remember a girl I dated in high school.
An Amanda?
No, it was a Kate.
That's right. I forgot.
She had an ex-boyfriend who, if I remember the stories correctly, was abusive and like was a real piece of crap. And beyond that, without getting too detailed into it, but I remember she never actually referred to him as his name. She called him Flem. And I agree with you right there. It takes away the power of the person and puts it back in your hands. In a sense, when you give him that nickname, it dehumanizes them, phlegm or whatever it is. So, and I think with the suspense and everything, you're right about the scene. In fact, I actually kind of appreciated that it doesn't happen in the first act of the novel. It happens closer toward the middle to the, or 2/3 of the way through, or that where she reveals it. Cause you're right. She has to come to terms with it before she tells us what happened. And so we get that, once again, I've used the word organically a few times. We do kind of get it organically. Like you'd almost expect this to be the way, if she's having such a problem speaking of it, she wouldn't come out and tell you what had happened right away. Is the rape scene, and this is ironic that I picked this novel because you know how much I hate sexual assault and rape in film and literature, with the caveat when it doesn't need to be there. And yet this is what the book is about. So you have to have the scene, right? Like, if she never had the scene, I think it wouldn't be that good of a novel, or because, like, why didn't you include that scene or some aspect of it? Is it appropriately done? Is it not graphic enough? Is it too graphic? Like, what, when you're reading this scene of her, of Andy raping her in, by the trees in the grass at a party, did you feel it was too much, not enough? Like, you know, what was your takeaway?
I think we don't really need more. Mm-hmm. I think that it is enough. And we're just talking about that one, right? Not the closet scene.
Just the party scene.
Yeah. I think because I appreciate it, because I think you see the conflict that, the survivor goes through, as well as what other people would potentially say about this in the victim blaming, because she does even comment that she had however many drinks and she was at least buzzed. She may have been intoxicated.
Yeah. She's
a 13-year-old child, so I'm sure. So it's almost in her mind already that, like, it was her own fault that this sort of thing happened. But it makes it very clear that she was saying no and stop, and that Andy is not listening to that. So I think that it serves the purpose of what needed to be done. And then, I guess the follow-up question, which you didn't really ask, is like, did it even need to happen on page? Could she have just said that, you know, Andy raped her? Was it, and I just wonder if that's maybe an authorial thing where you want to show, not just tell. And so you have to put it there. And also, I think it's real life, right? As much as we don't like these scenes, we know that they do in fact happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so if this can help any girl of any age to show that this is not, no matter your state of whether you're intoxicated or sober, that this should not be happening, then I think perhaps it should be on the page.
Yeah, I agree on that point exactly. From the storytelling standpoint, she's acknowledged it's happened so not much, but you get the feeling that she's never fully faced it. So this is her facing it because we're in her head. And you notice it's like, it's telling more than showing. Like, she's saying, like, she remembers these things happening, but it's almost like flashes of memory. So she's not getting, she's like, you know, it was this. It's very like simple sentence told. And I think that really works because it's almost told like in a panic, like it's rushing back to her. So I think it was handled very well. No, it didn't need to be more graphic. But I think it was just enough, especially because she's the victim here and because she's experienced the traumas and she's blocked part of it out too. And this is where it's coming back a little bit to her as well. And I think you're right. It does need to be shown in some regard, because that way somebody who needs to identify with this can. And it could also be like a cautionary tale of what boys are capable of, and like, you know, and mm-hmm. like what, you know, because like in, and I like the fact that you did point out that she brings up like how she was drunk and stuff, because we've seen a lot of times where people blame the victim,
right?
And alcohol is usually one of the things, or the way she was dressed, right? What was she wearing, and or was she flirting with him to begin with? You know, if she invited him in, she, et cetera, which is all wrong. Like, you know, the consent is consent. And if she says no, or I don't consent to this, he literally held his hand over her mouth. So, you know, it's not like she did consent at all, even if, but she's been trained by society and culture to question those things because of the way that, you know, we tend to be. Is it realistic to expect that he will receive some sort of consequences? Ugh. What perils does Mel face by finally speaking out, actually?
Yeah, so there's a movie that I love that I highly recommend to anyone. I've seen it so many times because I show it to new people. And it's called Promising Young Woman. directed by Emerald Fennell, which you might have, you know, ups and downs on her, but I do like that, and starring Carey Mulligan. And it's obviously a take on the promising young man situation of, you know, you don't want to ruin his reputation and things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to go to your first question, because he was a senior, he probably had, I don't remember if he was a jock of some sort.
I think he's a football player, but I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. I was like, was he a baseball player?
I'm getting, or a baseball player. Sense. Like, yeah, he, yeah, he's an athlete, I think.
Okay, so who knows if he was recruited, if he's got all that. So, and then social status, we know that he's popular. So I wonder, you know, are his parents connected? So I have lots of fears of, you know, speak part two, whether he would get out of it. But because Mel is, so I'll go backwards, I guess, in my secondary answer, because Mel is applauded by, I believe, a graduating senior, the very last day in Mr. Freeman's room, she said something like, you know, you went through a lot or something like that, but good job. It was something like that. That I think there would be many people behind her if slash when she goes to court against him. But the fear is, you know, that a man, you know, gets off because of hearsay, you know.
Yeah.
She said, he said, and again, you know, there are facts that I could pull up to say that. So the obvious repercussions that she could have is being more of a social pariah, that, you know, like, oh, you know, Andy was the, how could you do that? But because of the reactions of people, that, you know, Rachel, I think deep down felt something because of how she reacted to him at the dance, and I think he was feeling her up. And then again, the list of I don't know, pejoratives that were under his name in the bathroom stall, that I think she might be protected from that. I don't think that, like, I would not see her as Mel 2.0 in sophomore year, that all of a sudden she's like super bright, sunny, and popular, because I think that it's, so she's going to be processing all of this. But I don't think that she'll be treated like she was her freshman year.
I agree. By the way, the cheerleader says, way to go, I hope you're okay, or something to that.
Yeah. So, and because people caught them, right? Ivy and the lacrosse team or whatever.
Yeah,
so
they busted down witnesses, the door.
Yeah, which there is were helpful. Witnesses. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think that the frustrating thing is, because he's a high school athlete, there have been cases of high school athletes getting in trouble for these things, or college athletes who are getting in trouble for these things. And the way that the community will rally around them and treat them like they're misguided little boys who need to just learn a lesson, and how dare you ruin this boy's life with this, what you're saying? Like, we've heard that.
Yeah.
You're going to ruin his life by bringing, it's like, dude, he raped me. But again, there's a lot of toxic culture in high school, around high school athletes, around high school sports, especially boy athletes, and what they can get away with, especially in like smaller towns or things. I think of the Steubenville, Ohio, was where there was a rape case a number of years ago involving football players. And I want to say they actually were taping raping the girl. It was a horrific story, and the support that the guys got from the community, because they were upstanding young men who were on the football team, and how dare this girl ruin a reputation? And like, that is so prominent, and it had gotten worse over the last couple of decades because of social media, because sometimes we were posting stuff like this to, you know, to places so people could see. Yeah. And then with cyberbullying being what it is, there are cases where somebody has had to leave the school they're at even because they spoke up, where they've been bullied out of it. I don't, quote me on it, I want to say there's at least one case of a girl committing suicide because of the harassment she received, because she decided to speak the truth about the fact that she was raped. And it's so wrong.
Yeah.
But it's one of the problems with the culture. And I don't know if Anderson really had the space to explore that in this book, because she'd gone through all of the things so far. So it did kind of have to end on the note it ends on. I'm glad that Mel's okay. And I think if you're trying to get a message across to the reader that you can be okay if you speak up for yourself, you have to have the novel end this way. You can't have it end ambiguously or on the down note that Andy's going to get away with this or get off light. Because it's not empowering that way. And there is some empowerment at the end of the novel that I think works very well.
Yeah, because I think it's good to imbue people with hope that hopefully justice is met. Mm-hmm. I mean, the ideal situation is that we're educating people and that this sort of thing isn't happening. I'm thinking of, you know, you mentioned someone. I'm thinking of the BYU baseball player, which I'm sure you heard about, who was raping a girl for 5 years from 7 years old to 12. And he he basically got off with a slap on the wrist. Yeah. So like it is a problem, which I found very shocking. About one of the reasons why, you know, people are against this novel is because, you know, it's condemning young men, but the statistics are not lying.
No.
Yes, we can say, you know, hashtag not all young men, but like we have to educate in order for that to actually be true of, you know, these young men. Yeah. So yeah, I can appreciate that there was hope there, but part of me is like, I wonder if this would have happened. Like, why was the lacrosse team there? Why were they randomly in the, you know, so some of these things I'm like suspending disbelief in my hope of, yes, she would have been rescued.
Yeah.
But I wonder if like more realistically,
he
would have gone off to college and he just never would have paid any sort of penalty or It would have been very dark had she been raped again in that closet.
Yeah.
But I feel like maybe he would have gone off to college and that was it. But yeah, I'm glad that this was the way it was. But I think if I were to read this with students, I would talk about sort of like the realism of everything. And not in like a let's create a culture of fear situation, but just like let us be on guard. And let us know facts, and then how can we work to fix this as a society?
Yeah, I believe the suspension of disbelief or the of coincidence that the girls lacrosse team, because it was after school when this happens, so they were probably maybe they were in the hallway and they heard her. So at that point, she was yelling.
Yeah.
No. So maybe somebody they broke down. Somebody got to them, and you know somebody heard it and got more people, and they broke down the door, et cetera, et cetera. It frustrates me when I hear that argument that it was biased against male students or against young boys. The thing is, we need to be teaching young boys that sexual assault is wrong.
Right.
That not getting consent is wrong. That getting a girl drunk to the point where she can't physically consent is wrong. Everybody talks about, like, you know, how do you prevent it or how do you defend yourself or what should you do as a woman? But there's not enough education of these boys to say, this is how you behave sexually, that you are not entitled to a woman's body. And unfortunately, there's an entire culture built around the act, the idea that a man or a boy is entitled to the body of a girl or a woman. And we're doing a terrible job of teaching boys the proper way to act in that regard. Because either we don't want to expose them to sex, whatever, or we don't want to make them feel bad. It's like, if we want to get to the root of the problem of things like sexual assault and rape, we have to start taking care of the boys in that. We have to teach them these hard lessons of like, this is not what you do. And fathers have to step up and do that. It's because it should not be the women's job to educate them either. Like, so like there's a huge cultural shift that needs to happen. And because like, I don't want to hear another story about a guy raping a girl and then people being concerned when charges are brought up that you're going to ruin his life, because no, he shouldn't have been doing that. So again, I'm soapboxing again, but I do think that it needs to end on the note it ends on, because that way we get some sort of empowerment that's like, yes, you should speak up. Because you're right. If he raped her again and he went off to college, it would be like really dark at the end. And like, what the hell is the point? Right? Like, you're walking away from this book like, oh my gosh, this is just terrible. You know, 13-year-olds are going to be like, oh no, this is awful. And then we have like, this is probably a no-brainer. Did you get the feeling that Rachel was going to get raped by Andy at some point too?
It was certainly a fear.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't listening to Mel and the whole, it was prom, right? So,
prom,
I mean,
yeah.
The whole, I don't know, stereotype of prom is that people lose their virginities. And while she may have wanted to be with him in some like intimate capacity, I don't think that he would have been, I don't know even what the word is, gentlemanly about it. And so I think that it would have escalated quickly and something. Yeah. So I did worry. Yes.
I like the notebook conversation. I think that was a nice touch. People have notebook conversations all the time in high school. And Mel's being honest, and there's never been any point at which us, the reader, or even Rachel, would know Mel to lie. And yet Rachel gets really defensive and storms off when she says, Andy raped me. And then Rachel turns around to the prom and not only dumps him, but she says that she heard that he raped somebody, like right in front of everybody. Like he basically, that's one of the catalysts for her, like blowing up at him. Why get so upset at Mel and then turn around? Like, you know, like what happened over the course of that, like couple of days with Rachel? Like, did she have some sort of insight or something? Like, why did she react in such a violent way toward Mel when it was Andy that she said?
I think I don't know that I will be able to verbalize, but I felt like it was a realistic reaction of someone tells you a truth and you have an explosion of emotion at this because it upsets you so. And I think because of that, you know deep down that this is probably true. Whether or not she had heard it from other people or she got that sense. Because I feel like, was the girl from Poland? She clearly did not like Andy because he would try to be all smarmy with her. And it was from Mel's perspective. And so I wondered if her friend also was telling her some things like he's a creep. So I think it's like, I don't know, denial came out in big force. But then she was able to sort of reconcile like, oh, actually, and just needed some time to think on that. That's what I perceive it as.
I did too, and I also perceive that she was too embarrassed to talk to Mel about it by the way.
By the end?
Yeah. No, so because she finally does start to talk to Mel, like at the very, very end of the novel, she mentions, like, I think Rachel said to call her or whatever, if I'm remembering correctly. When we get home, there's a message on the machine from Rachel. She wants me to call her. So by the end of the novel, Rachel is reaching out to Mel. But, like, it's interesting that, like, she realized maybe she got home and she really gave it some thought and she realized, wait, Mel's telling the truth. And maybe she starts to see some of the red flags that she's seen, that she's been ignoring with Andy. But she never does go back to Mel and call her up and say, hey, I'm sorry about what I said at the library. You know, I've been thinking about it. Even after the prom incident, she doesn't really tell Mel about it. It's not until after the closet with Andy that she does. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But then again, that's pride and ego getting in your way too. And Rachel being the type who's definitely got her own sense of ego. And she was riding high on the fact that she was dating the senior. She's a freshman, right? I mean, that's a pretty big deal. I guess we'll close with the end of the novel and the scene with Andy attacking her. We brought it up a couple of times. Putting that suspension of disbelief aside, maybe he was stalking her, especially considering that Rachel broke up with him and embarrassed him at the prom, and he's tracing it back to Melinda and then the lacrosse team and everything. Like, what did you make of that scene? We talked a little bit about how he's violating her space and everything, and she smashes the poster in the window and she grabs the glass shard and everything. I mean, was it over dramatic? Did it fit the tone and everything? What did you make of it as far as the rest of the book is concerned?
Yeah, I don't think that it was overdramatic. I think, you know, in Westworld slash also Romeo and Juliet, you've got that line of these violent delights have violent ends, right?
Yeah.
And so it certainly feels that way. I mean, obviously the delight is like one-sided, in a very perverted way, with Andy. But yeah, the violence of it, I mean, I felt like anyone who perpetrates sexual violence, I think, is also capable of physical violence. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not far off. And then I think he's worried about maybe his reputation, and also, you know, he prevented him, I guess, from getting together with somebody. Though you think, you know, he's basically one foot out the door that he would just move on, but I don't know the mind of a predator. Yeah. So I don't think that it's overly dramatic. I think it's, yeah, just really scary because now it's in bright daylight. It's not at night. They're both sober. It's in a potentially safe place. So it's just like all of these things that I think are, I guess, break stereotypes of when and how and where rape happens. Mm-hmm. And again, that, you know, predators can happen anywhere.
Yeah. I also think that the way that she overcomes it has to be balanced with the way, with how far down she went on her in this journey of not speaking and everything. So it goes from this sphere to this scream and the whole thing. Is. So it matches the intensity of the rest of the book in a sense. Like, it isn't overdramatic because it has earned that through what we've seen Mel go through. So we're feeling good as an audience in a sense that she finally got the kid, but we're still left with the trauma and the scars that we have seen, because Mel's not cured by any means by what she does to Andy. She just is starting healing for real and such. All right. So before we're going to close out now with the final question, which is this required reading?
I think that it is. I think that it's something you can do with middle school and up and have a serious conversation. I think you could have it as a co-ed conversation, as well as maybe splitting students up and talking to them so that you can come at it at two different angles. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's an important book that people should be reading.
I agree. I think for all those reasons.
Wow.
All right. So you do have some feedback, and we have feedback on two particular episodes, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, which is episode 105, and Sharp Objects, which is episode 106. Stella is going to take us through the comments and feedback on Percy Jackson.
Yeah. So first from Robert Ward says, I had a coworker who loved the series and its sequel, Heroes of Olympus. This is one of a couple of books they recommended and that I read. I commented to Stella a few times last month about the book series, but honestly, I wasn't a fan of the writing of the original series. I feel Uncle Rick improved throughout, and I think the new Percy books are my favorite. My coworker actually loved the follow-up more, and I'm here to say that it was particularly strong. I love the expanding of core characters with characters of a couple minorities. I guess identities. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the Annabeth Percy or Perkabeth romance, but my favorite character is probably Frank from Heroes. Frank is a Chinese Canadian who has an excellent character storyline. The new books are great, by the way. More quests, but this time Percy has to fulfill his assignment so he can get college recommendations. Wow. One of the cool things about Uncle Rick's novels are that there are separate series and standalones, but they keep continuity in the longer, more popular Percy universe. This makes it difficult to recommend Sun and the Star, but it's a good one. Also, I was going to say, wasn't that also a YA romance that I made you read?
The Sun is also a Star.
Yeah. It, in major props to Rick. He was co-writer as he wanted to have a queer voice writing and not just his own. So that's lovely. From a recent EW interview where Rick speaks about the experience of co-writing, quote, "I've thought about everything you can possibly imagine," he said. "I really have enjoyed, for instance, writing the Nico D'Angelo new books with Mark Oshiro. Writing with Mark has helped me to understand Nico in a more authentic way, and it's yielded a book that is more than I could have done by myself. I would love to look at that for other characters and say, who is someone from this background who really knows what this character might be going through and would put a more authentic spin on what they've been through? That would be really fascinating to find other authors from those cultures who might want to adapt the characters," end quote. One of the funniest and biggest issues with the original audiobooks was that they didn't know where everything was headed. Luke Castellan was given this very West Coast surfer boy voice, for it to later be revealed towards the end of the series that he is from Connecticut, LOL. I found out about the musical before my coworker. Sadly, I only read the series about a year and a half after the production was in Chicago, so I missed it. The Hunters of Artemis are referenced in the second book, but don't appear properly until the third book, I think. Don't worry, Artemis doesn't have any offspring, good, like the other gods or lesser gods, but rather has the Hunters, a group of girls who have sworn loyalty to Artemis and have likewise sworn to celibacy, or sworn themselves to celibacy.
All right. Sharp Objects, we have two comments. One is from Robert Ward. "My progress through the book could be mirrored on a chart. As I grew closer to the end, the interest in watching the series declined. It was a good book, but it was such a rough ride, I couldn't imagine spending any more time with it. Thank you for another book that has likely scarred me for life."
Ooh.
"I still have not watched the show. I do intend to watch, but I think I need to put a little more distance between me and that, and I've got other things to watch." Gene Hendricks writes in on Facebook about Sharp Objects, and with the quote, and I believe this was yours because he's addressing you, "She should be held accountable for some of her actions. Sorry, Stella, but that's a hard no. Everyone should be held accountable for all their actions. Could there be mitigating circumstances that would lessen or eliminate repercussions for those actions? Sure. But that doesn't mean that those people aren't held accountable. Yes, he beats his wife, but he was abused as a child, so can we hold him accountable? Doesn't make sense, does it?" I get what you're saying. I'm trying to remember the context of which we were saying that.
Yeah.
It is a good point. And had we, there are other times when an issue like this will probably come up in something we're reading because of the way moral ambiguity abounds in literature and sparks debate like this.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I don't know what, you know, obviously the murder are the things that she should be held accountable for.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess different levels of actions, but I think, yeah, empathy comes into play a lot too. Like, we have to understand where these characters are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
All right. So that is it for this episode. Next time, if we've got any feedback for The Long Halloween, we will read it then. And so next time, what are we reading?
Yeah, so we're reading a book that has yet to be published. But that's okay. I'm going to give because we've read two, maybe three Dark Things in a row. And so Tom basically said something along the lines of, "You should choose smut," and I thought, "Well, that was Tom,
kind of half joking, but yeah, okay."
But you know,
what is December?
Yeah, and when he says something like that, I take it for serious. So we are going to read something that, well, I don't even know the level of it, but I have read something by her, so like moderate, maybe like three chili peppers of smut.
Okay,
but it's called Good Spirits.
Ooh.
By B.K. Borison.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We'll come back for that. Yeah. And until then, thank you very much for listening and take care.
Oh, yeah. And remember, as we get closer to Thanksgiving, hold on to your turkey bones and create a sculpture out of it.
Yep. Good night.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by two freaks. That's two true. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreading for Tom and Stella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review on iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.